Support for Jim Pease's Talk of Iowa Wildlife Call-In Program comes from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Details on how you can protect wildlife habitat are at inhf.org.
Many different forces have changed Iowa's landscape, from glaciers to the equally powerful force of human beings. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk about how Iowa has changed from the perspective of a goose. Wildlife expert Jim Pease will be here representing the geese of Iowa. He'll give us the goose-eye view of Iowa history, including some glacial geology, and a look at how the draining of wetlands and the tiling of fields impacted goose populations. We'll also talk about the different kinds of geese that make Iowa their home: Canada geese, snow geese, and the white-fronted goose. You're welcome to join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with us today, and he has told us that today he will not be speaking for himself, as he usually does. But, Jim, your intention today is to speak to us from the perspective of a goose.
Yeah, I'll try and use English, though, instead of goose-like.
I think that would be advisable, but you're going to waddle us through the natural history of
absolutely.
Iowa.
Absolutely. This is good. Honk if you like it, I guess. All the usual puns.
Well, I'm sure we'll come up with a few of those.
That's
and
right.
Maybe even some that are unusual today. But seriously, we're going to take a look at the natural history of the state of Iowa, and we're going to talk about how that natural history and the progression of the landscape in Iowa has affected goose populations here.
Right. It was amazing this morning as I drove in to the radio station here. There's a field right across from where I live in outside of Ames, and there were about 300 Canadas in there. It had just been picked within the last several days, cornfield, and they were all gleaning the waste corn off the ground. It was wonderful to see them, and they all seemed to wave as I went by, you know, and say, "Oh, we hear you're doing a program on us today. That's great." So,
did you stop and pick up a few pointers?
A few pointers. That's right. they said honk as you go by, and so I did, and they honked back. So it was great. But I thought it was telling because it you know, as a kid growing up in southeastern Iowa, I had the experience. I spent a lot of time outdoors, and I used to thrill when I to hearing and seeing a V of Canada geese as they would go over. And basically you saw them along that Mississippi River, and you might occasionally see a V going north in the spring or coming south in the fall. And that was just such a thrill. And I think today we've come to take that for granted because they are now so common. At that time, growing up in the 50s and 60s, they were not common at all. In fact, they were no longer nesting in Iowa, though they certainly once did. But and I think their history kind of reflects the history of Iowa, and that's why I chose this topic today, because I really think it looks pretty nicely at the sort of what's happened to the Iowa landscape.
Well, let's start with that. Let's talk about the first, well, maybe not the very first, but some of the early forces that shaped Iowa after the glaciers came through. What did Iowa look like?
Well, when the glaciers came through, what they 10 to 12,000 years ago, this sheet of ice covered the north central third of the state, about 34, 35 counties in north central Iowa, ending in Des Moines, about where the Capitol building sits in Des Moines, is sort of an end moraine. It's that last sort of pile of rock at the head of the glacier. That's where the Capitol sits. It sits on one of the end moraines of the last glacier that passed through here. 10-12,000 years ago, you're talking about a sheet of ice that's a mile or so thick. I mean, that's incredible. And when it receded, when it all melted back, it left behind thousands and thousands of shallow water wetlands all throughout that part of Iowa, what we now call the flats of Iowa. It's flat because the glaciers went through there. Those folks who go on Ragbrine know that if you take a northern route through Iowa, it's a lot easier in terms of hills than it is if you take a route through southern Iowa, because it's an older landscape, much more eroded, and has lots and lots more hills to climb and to go down on your bike.
Well, I think a lot of people who live in Iowa think about Minnesota as the land. Obviously, it's the land of lakes, and that's where the glaciers left all of those 10,000 lakes. But I don't think we do think of Iowa as having a lot of wetlands.
Right, but we did. And when our ancestors, the Euro-American ancestors, came here in the 1830s, that's one of the things they had to deal with, was all these thousands and thousands of wetlands that inhabited the whole northern part of the state. Since we're just past Columbus Day, let me take a flyover of what the state looked like when Christopher Columbus landed somewhere on the East Coast. What the Iowa landscape of the time looked like.
And all right, so this is roughly 1492.
14,
right?
Yeah, more or less, give or take you know, 20 years. I'm flying over, and as I come down from where I or come north, there are lots and lots of places to stop along the way. There are wetlands. I'm looking down, and there are dots of nice little ponds, what from the air look like they've got plants sticking up out of them. And, boy, lots to eat and lots of great places to nest. And those are the wetlands that the glacier left behind. And they were often there maybe until mid-July, you know, when it would get drier. This is the prairie landscape of Iowa, and the wetlands were often temporary, shallow water wetlands. It would be wet all spring into the summer and provide wonderful feeding habitat for me and my goslings. And my mate, and we could find great places to nest because there was lots of adjacent upland in these areas, or there might be lakes with or ponds with islands in them that were nice and safe from the predators, and we had lots of choices. Well, let's fast forward now up into the 1830s, 1840s. Iowa was had been settled, of course, by Native Americans for many thousands of years, hadn't been settled or was beginning to be settled by Euro-Americans after the Black Hawk War, and when they came here, they were told by law that they needed, and these are laws that were passed in 1849, 1850, that said if you're going to homestead in Iowa, you have to drain those wetlands and make them productive. And that's a direct quote from the federal law. That was what our ancestors were told to do: drain them and make them productive.
It seems remarkable that yeah. People came here in the 1830s and even had the power to drain those wetlands.
It is incredible. If you go to the State Historical Building, you can see sometimes the pictures of these farmers digging these ditches 3 and 4 feet deep by hand to lay down clay tile in there to drain these wet areas. And that's how it was done. We see machines as the fields are being harvested. There's still lots of tiling going on. Machines are going in the fields now and tiling a whole field in a day, no problem, or a couple of days.
Right, with flexible plastic tubing.
Right, exactly. And boy, it's times have changed. It took weeks and weeks of very hard labor to hand dig those lines and lay those tiles down to drain those fields. So, and there's some wonderful old photos that make you realize, gee, this is not something you undertook, you know, with carefree. You had to invest a lot of labor in this.
How quickly did that change the landscape? Because obviously that was, at that point, a tremendous effort, and a lot of homesteaders didn't make it. Yeah, obviously, yeah. Eventually, Iowa was settled by Europeans, and many, many of those fields were drained. Almost all of those fields were drained eventually. But how fast did that transition take place?
It's amazing. When you think about a landscape like Iowa that existed as tall grass prairie with lots of wetlands in it for 5,000 plus years, in a relatively short span of time, about 50 years, about half a century, and you could stretch that to maybe a century, but basically in a pretty short span of time, most of them were drained. That laws that I talked about from 1849 and 1850, drain them and make them productive, remained in effect until 1978. Until Jimmy Carter finally said by executive order, that is no longer the rule of the law of the land. Amazing that it stood that long, because we, of course, ecologically know that these wetlands are some of the most productive areas in the world, not the least, but the most productive. It didn't produce the things that we were looking for, corn and beans and wheat and those kinds of crops, but they're very productive if we think in a strictly sort of biological sense. And one of the things they produced, of course, were lots and lots of wetland critters, i.e. geese and ducks and swans and all kinds of things. But as we drained them, particularly when the steam shovel came in the late 1800s, the drainage went much more quickly. You didn't have to dig them by hand. You could take a big machine in there and dig these ditches and lay down clay tile pretty quickly. So in less than a century, we'll put it that way, we changed the landscape very, very quickly that had stood as an amazing wildlife refuge for thousands of years.
Well, and of course, at the same time, those homesteaders, those settlers, would have loved to have had goose for dinner. And what was the hunting pressure like on these species?
The hunting pressure was pretty extreme. The geese, of course, nest on the ground. And in those days, when you're homesteading is tough business. It takes a lot of energy to
dig all those trenches,
dig those
and
trenches,
those fields,
yeah, build those railroads, all that sort of thing. And where did they get the protein to do that? They got it from the landscape. That's why bison and elk and deer disappeared very quickly. Geese and duck populations were, and there were no laws. Essentially to protect any of those species. You took what you wanted, when you wanted, as many as you wanted, and nobody could tell you otherwise because there were no laws. And even where there were laws, there were basically nobody to enforce them. And by the turn of the last century, by 1900, geese, Canada geese, had been eliminated from nesting in the state of Iowa. And actually by 1900 had been, and by the 1930s had been decimated over their whole range, which is a huge range, across the United States.
Well, we'll talk more
literally from coast to coast.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Jim Pease is my guest. We're talking about natural history of Iowa from the perspective of geese today. And we'll talk more about those species and the other changes that have affected them in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and today we are talking wildlife with wildlife consultant Jim Pease. And today we're specifically talking about geese, and we're taking a look at Iowa's natural history from the perspective of geese. Jim, before settlement, before all of those wetlands were drained, and mm-hmm. before the hunting pressure, how many species of geese probably lived in Iowa?
Well, just one nested here, and that was the Canada geese. And if you look at Canada's today, you will see a whole range. There's of races. There's the giant Canada, and they're the ones that were common here. Certainly, lesser Canadas. Okay, we're talking a giant Canada goose. This is a goose that's about a 10-pound goose. Okay, this is the big one, and they range from to lesser Canadas, which are about a 6-pound critter. Down to the cackling goose, which is about a 3.5-pound, but they all look like Canadas. Cackling, I think, looks. You can see the range in sizes. So you're dealing from 10 to 3 or 3.5 pounds. But the giant Canada is certainly nested in Iowa. The other species of geese that we see here usually during migration, are the snow geese and the white-fronted goose. And those really nest in the far north, in the Arctic tundra and the taiga of northern Canada. So we're really very and Canada's will nest up there too, but basically the only goose species that nested in Iowa was the Canada goose.
Well, we'll talk more about the individual species, those three species, in a few minutes, but I think we're not quite done with the
right.
natural history
sure.
Of Iowa. So this has brought us to settlement and basically, you know, a lot of hunting pressure. The wetlands have been drained, but we kept going with those efforts.
Yeah, we did. There were lots of efforts to at the turn of the century, people like Teddy Roosevelt and that whole generation of sort of emerging conservationists made a huge difference. A guy by the name of John Lacey, Colonel John Lacey, who was an Iowa congressman in 1901, passed the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and made it illegal. Basically established the idea that for migratory species, the federal government had a precedence over state governments in terms of those, although state governments still had to enforce things. And then the emergence of people like Ding Darling, Aldo Leopold, all names that are Iowans that we take great pride in thinking that, boy, it's those folks that made the difference and made the change, put laws in place that protected wildlife species, that established things like seasons and bag limits and things like that that hadn't existed before, and enforced them. It wasn't until Ding Darling went to Washington in the mid 1930s, that and became the head of what was called the Biological Survey, eventually became the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that a lot of those federal laws were even enforced. He was the first person to really send federal game wardens out to enforce the laws that had been on the book for a generation, and that was a big change. We think about that today and think, my golly, it couldn't have always been that way, but it was. This was pretty lawless times. You took what you wanted when you wanted, and it was a fundamental change, I think, in the way in which wildlife were treated and looked at.
You know, Iowa doesn't have any national parks.
Right.
Was there a feeling, obviously not among the people that you're talking about, but was there sort of a feeling that because Iowa didn't have these spectacular vistas, that this is all land to be used? This is not land to be saved.
Well, it wasn't just Iowa. I think land was looked at very much that way in general. We were a utilitarian society. We were trying to make it as a country, much as many emerging economies are trying to do today. They're exploiting their natural resources, and we look at them today from the perspective of a successful, you know, strong economy, and we look down on them and we say, oh, you shouldn't do that to your natural resources. Well, we've already done that, of course. So it's easy to condemn others. And in fact, we were simply building our economy, and land was looked at as a resource to be exploited, to be used. Manifest destiny of our country to use those resources to build a country, and to tame it was in fact the idea that was a good thing. We were going to tame the landscape, tame the prairies, tame the wilderness, and we've changed today. I think that's one of the things that the last half century, or the last century, in fact, has shown us that in fact we are members of the land community, citizens of it, and only one of the citizens, the other citizens being wild critters and other wild species that share this landscape with us.
Well, even after people started talking about preservation or even restoration of wetlands in Iowa, there was still pressure on the farmers to make their land as productive as possible. And certainly I remember watching a creek get straightened,
sure.
and, you know, and the attempt made to bury it in my lifetime. You know, that was not very long ago. So the pressure on the wetlands in Iowa continued.
Oh, sure. It continues to this moment. In fact, certainly the pressure. Certainly, when you're paying taxes on land, you want to have something that you can show for it. And in Iowa, the way we show that that profit on the land is to plant it or graze it or in some way domesticate it so that it is producing income for you. And that's an understandable, I think, desire. And one of the ways we've done that, in fact, you mentioned the idea of straightening the stream. We channelize. It's called channelization. We've channelized a lot of streams. Iowa, if you go west, if you've spent much time beyond the western borders of Iowa, you realize how rich we are in terms of rivers and streams. We have more miles of rivers and streams per capita than practically any state in the union. It's amazing, and we sort of take them for granted. If you go west and you realize, gee whiz, it's pretty remarkable that we've got all these, not just shallow water wetlands, but all these streams and rivers, and yet we've exploited them. In fact, if you look at Iowa City, Iowa Falls, Cedar Falls, all of those things, and you could go the names of cities all around the state, their name for the river course that they were on. And they settled there for some very specific reasons. It provided transportation. It provided certainly a source of water, but it also took the wastes of our gradually industrializing society, took them away, which meant, of course, downstream. And you wanted to take that away as quickly as you could. And so we've used those rivers and streams basically as sort of conduits for waste disposal. And unfortunately, they've also been conduits for soil from the land as well, because we were using them as a resource to build our economy and not thinking, I think, and again, I don't think this was necessarily people who were, you have to consider the knowledge that was available at the time. And I think that as we've grown in knowledge, we understand that wetlands and rivers are critical to our very, that natural resource base is intimately linked to our economy and our well-being.
Well, and certainly it is such a rich land here, and it has been such a rich land here that I'm sure there was a time when people believed that it doesn't matter how much soil washes away. It doesn't matter, because it's always going to be a rich land.
Sure, yeah, yeah. And it is. I mean, but when we lose an average of 5 tons per acre per year across the state, and if we don't replace that, don't allow it to replenish itself, keep the soil on the land, we won't have productive soils down the road someplace.
So we were talking about Canada geese and how they've pretty much, they had disappeared from the state of Iowa, and certainly that is not the case anymore. But
no.
I do remember in my childhood that seeing a Canada goose was a pretty special thing.
Yeah.
And they are Canada's, they're not Canadian.
That's right, that's right. Well, some of them are Canadian.
Right.
But Canadian Canada. So Canada is sort of the official name. And a lot of people, it doesn't bother me a lot, people make that mistake. But that's the species name is Canada goose. And even though they may come from the U.S. or even Mexico, they're Canada geese. So, yeah, not Canadian. Beginning in the 1960s, as this sort of emerging environmental conscience was beginning to emerge in a much more general way, there were this tight group of folks that in the first half of the 20th century, I mentioned Leopold and Gifford Pinchot and Ding Darling and Teddy Roosevelt, that the sort of we think of them as the conservationists that really changed the public attitude and public laws, as a matter of fact. They had to have some way to fund what they wanted to do. And in 1937, there was an act called the Pittman-Robinson Act that was passed that put, it was actually encouraged to be passed by hunters and by sportsmen's groups to tax themselves. They put excise taxes on firearms and ammunition. And that, those excise taxes were then distributed to the states for such things as restoring wetlands and buying up habitat and making sure that the soil stayed on the land. And that idea that you could have money then that would actually make a difference in terms of habitat was a novel idea, and hunters and anglers taxed themselves to make sure that there was money available. In the 1960s, then it began to, you know, this sort of environmental conscious took over much more of the public, and the Iowa Conservation Commission began at that time to try to restore Canada goose populations in Iowa. And you say, well, how do they do that? Yeah, you can put habitat back on, but is it build it and they will come? Not quite. You've got to have some birds to come from someplace. And so across the upper Midwest, there were efforts by a number of conservation commissions, now called the DNR, to raise birds and then re-release them in the wild. Much as we've done with wild turkeys and otters and a number of other things, and deer for that matter, we've often had to take from captive populations. And so they did that with giant Canadas, and in the 1960s they began to release them. But it really wasn't, and they grew gradually, very, very gradually, but it really wasn't until the wetland restoration programs of the 1980s with the Farm Bill programs that real progress was made. And goose populations since the mid-70s and 80s in particular have grown more than 7% per year, and that's a pretty healthy growth rate, and have really done very, very well. In fact, they nest again all over Iowa, and it's no longer just known for spreading fall and spring goose music, as it's been called, but many of them are actually year-round residents where they can find open water and food. And in fact, in some urban areas, have become pest problems.
Definitely. Well, let's listen to a little bit of goose music here. Right. Here is a Canada speaking to us.
Deep resonance.
Right. There. It sounds like even a little bit of hissing in there.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be a pair. They do this whole neck bobbing routine. They throw their head back and kind of bob back and forth. It's a dance, if you will, the goose dance. And it's quite beautiful if you know what you're looking at. I suppose it looks kind of weird to folks who don't. I think my dancing might look weird to geese, too. I don't know.
do you pattern your dancing on geese?
No. More after sandhill cranes, you know. It's that sort of jumping and throwing yourself around.
Well, if you'd like to join our conversation about geese and share some of your personal experiences with geese in Iowa, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill is on the line from Sac City. Hello, Bill.
Oh, hi, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling. What would you like to talk about?
Well, Canada geese seem to be much more common now. Well, they are much more common now than they were several decades ago, as you described.
Mm-hmm.
And we see them in a lot of urban areas, and they seem to have adapted to a niche created by man and represent a species which perhaps may be out of balance in nature.
Sure.
And I believe this is also seen with the white-tailed deer. They've adapted to mm-hmm. urban settings, and I would appreciate your thoughts on this, Dr. Pease.
Yeah, I mentioned right at the end of before we took your call that in fact they've become a pest in some places. There was a friend of mine in the late 1980s who had worked in goose control in a couple of other states, and he said to me, as we were seeing success in reestablishing geese in giant Canadas nesting in Iowa. He said to me, he says, mark my words, he says, they will be the starlings of the 90s for Iowa. It was a sort of a forewarning of what was to come. They have adapted very, very well. Are you a golfer by any chance?
I'm familiar with what they do to golf.
Yeah. We have to remember that geese are, first and foremost, they are grazers. And we've created this incredible landscape. We put all this grass out there for them. We mow it regularly so there's nice fresh stuff coming up all the time. We water it. We even fertilize it. And then we put a pond in the middle of it. We call them water hazards, but they don't think of it that way. They think they've died and gone to goose heaven, you know. this is perfect goose habitat. And they are simply responding to that habitat we provided. We also provide wonderful ponds with mowed areas outside in front of many of our home offices of a number of businesses, and geese flock there, and we'll even keep that water open sometimes year round with aerators and things like that, and so it allows geese to stay here year round, and it can be a very, very serious problem, particularly if you're a golfer stepping in goose poop, and and the damage they do to the golf courses can be quite severe.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for your call. We'll talk more about geese in a moment. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Jim Pease is here today, our wildlife expert who comes by once a month to talk about wildlife in Iowa. And today we're talking about geese. We've taken a look at the natural history of the state of Iowa from the perspective of geese. And right now we're talking about Canada geese, which had once pretty much disappeared from the state of Iowa and have made a tremendous comeback. Jim, tell us a little bit about these geese. Do they mate for life?
Well, that's what we used to think. Certainly, they are monogamous within a given nesting season. But as a goose, I'll stay with my mate that year. But, you know, migration, gee, you meet all these other geese along the way. I tend to shift. Sometimes my mate will get shot during a hunting season someplace. You know, tend to switch off a little more than usual. When a goose mates, they do establish that pair bond, and there's a very strong pair bond for that nesting season. They both participate in the incubation. They both participate in raising that those young. Unlike a lot of other ones, but they are strongly bonded for that season. They return to Iowa if you're migratory. They return to Iowa very, very early. Leopold wrote about this in Sand County Almanac when he talked about geese coming back. When they do, as early as they do, mid to even early March, sometimes they're sort of betting the farm that field is going to be clear of snow, or that pond is going to be open, or that lake is going to be open, and it's quite a bet. And sometimes they lose that bet, but they'll come, they'll find that wetland, and they tend to be very strongly tied to a site, the natal site where they're born. So they're what we call site tenacious. They will tend to come back to that same pond year after year after year. And because that's where they're born, often some of the young will come back there. And this leads to some of the problems that we've seen in urban areas and in some lakes in the state, that the population grows from year to year, and the nesting population, even though the young are often driven off by the parents when it's nesting season, they may just drive them to the other end of the lake. And so you get more and more pairs nesting there, and it can become a serious problem.
How many goslings would a pair produce every year?
Yeah, well, they'll lay from 4 to 5 or 9, up to 9 eggs, and usually bring off an average of 5 to 6 young goslings per nest. And it takes about a month in incubation. They'll set on those eggs for a month. And the amazing thing is that these young are precocial. That means they're within 24 hours of hatching, they are out swimming with their parents. The little downy chicks are really, really cute. The little goslings are out there swimming. And the parents are teaching them the ways of the world. Occasionally, you'll see 3 adults with a group of goslings.
I was just going to ask about that.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because they sometimes have what appears to be an aunt. Canada geese don't usually breed until the 2nd or 3rd year of life. And so you have this year-old, usually a sibling, that is sort of tied particularly to the female and to her mother, and will actually help assist in raising the young, running off predators, showing them the ways of the world.
Well, and sometimes I've seen females or, you know, groups of Canada geese with just an impossible number of goslings. Do they ever group? Do they have, like, nursery groups?
Yeah, they do. Not only nursery groups, but often if a female or a male gets killed or for some reason is driven off by a coyote or hit by a car or something like that, they will be adopted, particularly if they're very close in age. Be adopted by another family, and you'll see these 12, 15 goslings in a group and say, my golly, how are they doing this, you know? So it does happen, and they're quite readily taken up, actually, by other geese.
And how long do they live?
Well, it all depends. If you make it through, as with most wildlife species, if they make it through that first fall, that's they're most vulnerable. They have to make it through the summer first, and that's the hard thing because you can be eaten by, if you're even goslings are not too big for some things like snapping turtles, and certainly are taken by coyotes and bobcats and other predators in these wetland areas. And then you make it through the first fall. Migration is a very tough thing. You have to have enough fat reserves to migrate. You have to know where to go, how to get there, and you have to, you know, follow the group. It's very difficult, plus there's the hunting pressure. And so if you're a young gosling, first year, inexperienced, you are much more likely to be shot or killed or die than not. But if you make it through that first year, chances are much better. Although mortality rates in geese are, you know, greater than 50%, depending on where you go and how you get there, there's a good chance that you'll last 5 or 6 years without too much problem at all.
5 or 6. I thought they could live longer than that.
They can. They can live 10 or 12 years or longer without any problem. But again, you
it's
have
just
to think
not
about
usual.
Yeah, there's hunting pressure. There's all sorts of things. So.
Tom is on the line from Iowa City. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Well, actually, you answered several of my questions right off the bat.
Okay.
I'll just kind of wing it here.
Okay.
A man.
Well, thanks for calling, Tom.
Yeah, I couldn't resist.
Yeah, good.
You mentioned about losing weight. Don't they, when they migrate from several thousand miles, they lose almost half of their body weight?
Well, some geese do. Yeah, if these are Canada geese or snow geese or white-fronted geese that are actually nesting in the Arctic, you're exactly right. Like many waterfowl, they'll lose 30, 40, even 50% of their body weight in some cases during the migration. And that's a tremendous amount. Talk about a weight loss program. My golly. That'd be pretty extreme. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how much weight they can lose. That's the importance of having some stopovers on the way. I mentioned that if I was a goose flying over here in Columbus when Columbus landed in 1492 more or less, I would see lots and lots of wetlands. As those got drained, I had fewer and fewer choices. And in Iowa, we've been, depending on whose estimates you take of how many wetlands were here in the 1830s, we've drained between 90 and 95 or 96% of the wetlands in the state.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
There are a lot fewer choices along the way.
Those
choices become very, very critical.
Very limited.
Yeah, it's the reason that, in fact, we often see these great concentrations, particularly of snow geese. Have you ever been to DeSoto Bend National Wildlife Refuge in Western Iowa?
No, I have not.
Oh, you should go. It's incredible. It's truly remarkable to see, you know, you can see 400,000 and 500,000 snow geese at
now, the
one
Horicon
time.
Marsh?
Horicon Marsh is famous for the Canada goose migration.
Right, southern Wisconsin.
Right, in Wisconsin.
It's beautiful
right.
to watch the V's come in. You can see them from miles away.
It's truly amazing, yeah, when you see these great concentrations. But we think about why we have those concentrations. It's in part because we've eliminated the choices, you know, and so it's wonderful to see these incredible concentrations of wildlife. But to realize at the same time that it makes them vulnerable because they're in one location, a single climatic event, a big storm or a disease can run through a flock and kill off a large portion of them very,
decimate
very quickly.
Them, yeah. I've got a cute story to tell you. When my mom was young, and this would have been about 1920, she got bit in the tush. By a goose.
By a goose.
Uh-huh. It really hurt.
I'm sure.
She was probably 7 years old or something at that time. But I have one question. Why is it every once in a while when you watch the V's up in the sky, they aren't quite going straight north or south?
Right. Right.
Is that just a pattern that they've developed over the years, or are they just a little off base?
No, they're certainly following flyways, but they take advantage of the winds that are available. And the winds on the surface are not necessarily what they're taking advantage of a little higher up. And those winds are usually from the northwest rather than straight west or straight north. And so they'll often be sideways. And they may be going out from a night roost to a day feeding area, hunting for a field to feed in throughout the day, like the one I saw this morning. Did you notice that often those V's are, you know, one side is shorter than the other? You know why that is?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, there are more geese on one side than the other.
Okay.
Sorry.
Scientific. Tom, thank you so much for your call. And of course, there is a reason that we call it goosing somebody. If you pinch somebody, geese are not
prone
right. to
that's that. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And his mother experienced that, certainly. So
exactly.
Right, right.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the other geese that also pass through Iowa. So the Canada geese are the ones that nest here. But we also see the snow goose. I think we have a little bit of snow goose sound.
Oh, good.
It's so interesting that they're higher pitched than
higher
the Canadas,
pitched.
But they're so much bigger.
Yeah, yeah. It is amazing. They're amazing to hear them. And you can hear the flocks coming. If you tune your ears to that higher pitched goose sound, you say, "Oh, those are snow geese that are coming." And in fact, snow geese used to migrate just along the western side of the state. I mentioned DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge out near Missouri Valley in western Iowa. But now they're migrating. There are so many of them across breeding in the Arctic now that they've established trying to control the population a little bit. We're seeing migrants right through central Iowa, clear through eastern Iowa, along the Mississippi Flyway as well as the Missouri Flyway, which is very different than it used to be. And they're not really they I think they look bigger to us because they're white with those black wingtips, but they're really a little bit smaller. They do look big. 5 to 7.5 pounds basically. So yeah, they're about the size of a what we call the lesser Canada. Right.
When I look at Canadas, I can tell the difference between the males and females from the way that they carry their necks.
I'm pretty sure I can.
But are there striking differences when you look at snow geese and look at Canada geese between males and females?
No, there aren't. Okay. Juveniles and adults, yes, but males and females, very little difference between them. It's very, other than occasionally behavior. We were talking about predation. I remember watching a pair of Canada geese when I was doing research up in Alberta, and I was watching this pair of Canada geese. One was on the nest. One was defending it against a coyote, and the coyote was determined to get to that nest and get those eggs or get one of the geese. And the other goose drove the coyote away. They're giant Canadas are something to be reckoned with, and the coyote knew it and couldn't get to the nest. It was quite remarkable to see. So they're pretty defensive of their nest sites and quite large. Snows, on the other hand, being a little smaller, they can defend their nests against most things, but certainly against Arctic foxes and things like that. But the goslings are a whole other thing, and they often frequently get taken by predators in the north.
Well, we also have a little bit of sound from the white-fronted goose, which is a species that we don't see nearly as often,
right.
I don't think.
But. That's beautiful.
And they are higher pitched still.
Yeah, yeah. And they're actually a little bit smaller, too, they're quite a bit smaller than the giant canids. They're more the size of the snow goose.
They look kind of like domestic geese.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, they look like pilgrim geese, I think, which is a domestic species. And they're called white-fronted, not because of white on their belly, but because of white around the bill. They have these bright orange legs and kind of a pinkish bill, and then this white fronted. The white front of their face is white, and that's why they're called that, not because they have white fronts to their white bellies, although some of them will.
And where do they nest?
They nest in the Arctic, in the far northern Arctic and the taiga, just south of there in northern Canada. So they're definitely a northern bird, and so we see them during migration only.
I don't think I've ever seen them. Maybe very high up.
Yeah, they're often in mixed flocks with snows and sometimes Canadas as well.
Dennis is on the line. I don't think we're going to have time to take his call, but he's calling with that question that you see different varieties of geese flying together. Is that common to see mixed flocks?
Yeah, it is. It's quite common. They'll often be, although generally a flock of snows will be a flock of snows. You may have what are called blues, used to be thought to be a different species, but found to just to be a different race of that, and mixed juveniles and adults. So they may look like different species, but may not be. But sometimes you will see a nice mixed flock of geese.
Well, and before I let you go here today, Jim, we've been talking about Iowa wetlands all day, and I know that you wanted to mention, with Election Day coming up, that Iowans are making a decision about Iowa wetlands.
Yeah, yeah. Canada goose populations have recovered, even to the point of being a nuisance in some areas. But I think we would do well to remember that it's not always this way. Geese and other wildlife nearly went the way of the passenger pigeon and were extirpated. It's certainly through deliberate efforts of a relatively small group of people, wildlife professionals and government officials who passed laws and provided funding that made it all possible. And on November 2nd, for the first time, we, the voters, have a chance have an opportunity to influence the future of conservation in Iowa. The Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund could be established by the passage of Question 1 on the ballot on November 2nd. And that fund could provide money to provide incentives for landowners to voluntarily protect wetlands, conserve soils, help clean up rivers and streams, and establish habitat for geese and other critters, including habitat for people. So I urge you to learn more about this vote. Go to voteyesiowa.org and then vote on November 2nd. The geese are honking their approval. I can hear them.
Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Jim Pease, wildlife consultant, is based in Ames. He joins us once a month to talk about the wildlife of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we'll talk about winterizing your home with home improvement expert Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.